I'll tell you what this is first. This is, what, July the 14th, 1967, in Denver, Colorado, at the home of Mrs. Cora Emanuel. And we're having a family reunion. And at this particular time, the various members of the family, the children, are sitting here trying to dig up certain memories. And while they're thinking, Mama herself is getting ready to tell a story, which something tells me I might cut off at any minute if it doesn't sound quite right, but we'll listen to see what she has to say. You can pick up that, you can pick that up if you want to and talk. You don't.
Which part?
You don't have to, just talk, just talk, it'll pick up.
I had a nice young fried rooster, and it was hard for me to kill a chicken without just mutilating his head and neck. So I thought I'd get James to do it for me. And I gave him a stick, which I sometimes use and to put over the chicken's head to hold him on the ground and then jerk up real quick and break his neck. Well, James did that. I don't want to get ahead of my story. There were some white men out in the front fixing the sewer, and they were sitting down eating their lunch. Well, when I gave James this stick to break this chicken's neck, he put the chicken down there and jerked him up as I told him and threw the chicken over his head, and the chicken walked away. And the chicken was just partly stunned, and I guess James was too. I said, "Oh, James, please don't let him get away." And James went to running after the chicken, and those men began to laugh, and that just hurt James no end. Then he got kind of stubborn again, so I said, "Catch him, James, catch him." And the men laughed so hard, but James finally caught the chicken. And we killed him, and I had to take him and mutilate his head and chop his head off.
Well, I don't know about that story, about its authenticity, but we'll take it at its face value. Now, what I want to do now, I assume that all of you had time to think. And so this lady in the red shorts, would you pick up that, I wonder if I can hear you. Maybe you better pick it up. Yeah. Your name, you holding that mic. Your name is what?
Dorothy Christine.
Dorothy, your name is Dorothy?
Yes, Christine.
All right, tell us who you are, please, and then maybe you'll give us some memory out of your childhood.
I'm the...
We know you're still relatively a child, but I mean earlier in your childhood.
Well, nothing in particular, I don't think, but I remember Saturday movies and the good hot breads we used to have. Remember all those rolls you used to bake? Mm-hmm. And, I don't know, little parties and picnics and this, that, and other. But nothing in particular that I can think of right now.
Could I intervene?
Really?
Could I intervene? Well, Chris, you tell them about the time when you and Alvin went to the store and got a box of whiting fish and how the cats gathered along and followed you home, and how really disgusted you were by the time you got there, and the cats was meowing, you was trying to keep the box out of the way, and Alvin had a little red wagon, he put it in, and that come rattling down the street, and I went out to see what it was all about, and I seen all those cats, and you was trying to shoo them away while Alvin was guarding the box of fish. You don't remember it?
That's a good story. Chris, maybe that'll nudge your memory so that you can think of something else. We'll come back to you, man. We'll come back to you.
Well, James, do you remember the cat that we had?
Well, she's been on me once already, but go ahead.
call Napoleon that you dislike so very much?
Oh,
that's
very
old.
No, I don't remember Napoleon, but I have.
No, we had Polly when Alan was.
Yeah, Napoleon.
Jim wasn't there.
Remember a cat.
Yeah, was glad.
All the cats I remember, however, I don't have any like.
Well, I couldn't tell really about this particular incident, but I want to remind you of the cat. Well, Napoleon, he was a little kitty mewing one night at the door, and I went out to see what it was all about. And so I opened the door, and there he was, and I took him in. He was a cute little thing, and he grew to be such a fine-looking cat, just a regal animal. So one day he left without any notice and went off and stayed about a year. And he came back and sat in the front room window where he had been accustomed to sitting when he was a kitten. He stayed one day, then he left. We never saw him again. Seemed like he came back to thank us for taking him in when he was a little helpless baby kitten out in the cold, but he was beautiful.
What do you know? At least that's a good story.
And Rover did the same thing, didn't
it? He went away?
No, it was Cody. Cody.
Cody.
Rover.
Yeah.
That's right. I remember Rover. Rover was in Denver with us, wasn't he?
Well, yes, he was here. We took him back to Alliance also.
And back to Alliance again. Mm-hmm.
You don't remember Rover?
Oh, indeed I do.
Yeah.
Mama, who is the young lady sitting over there with the glasses on?
Oh, that's Mrs. Smith.
Mrs. Smith.
Miss Gladys Smith.
Oh.
Your sister.
Oh, yes. I see. I was getting ready to ask her who she was.
Oh, yes. Gladys Antoinette Emmanuel Smith, I'll have you know.
Antoinette and Napoleon, we're getting some famous names here.
Oh, you were asking us to recall. It seems why I'm so nice now. I was so bad when I was little, I guess. I can't tell you my pet name for people when I get mad at them when I was little. I don't want this to be censured. But one of the things...
You're talking about me?
Not Ethan.
You're not talking about me, are you?
No, I'm not talking about
because
you.
Because I would
just
be
people
this, I would censure it.
Oh, yes, I know you would. Yeah. You'd erase it off the tape.
No, I'm only...
But one of the most memorable times is when we got up about 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning to go to the fair at Hemingford, Nebraska. I know everyone knows Hemingford, Nebraska. Do you, Jimmy? Oh, you don't. Quite a city, about 2,000 people. But that was quite a thrill to get up that early and get ready to go to the fair. I'm so excited, I forgot what happened at the fair, really. I think this would have a special meaning to Jimmy. Heave-ho, Mamie. She-five, Willie.
Yeah, I remember that all right. Maybe you can follow through on that memory, Gladys, by...
What were we doing?
We were
working.
We were washing dishes. Mm-hmm. And this statement had something to do with our ejecting candle flies or moths that would come in. What do you call them, candle flies?
Yes.
And we disliked them intensely. We had a routine that we went through to get rid of them by slapping at them with tea towels, dish towels, whenever they could come in, and we would do it in unison. And our signal was heave-ho, Willie.
Mamie.
Heave-ho, Willie. Heave-ho, Mamie. And then she-fi, Willie. And then we'd swing and get the mud and the camera flies. Yeah.
Yeah, well, I think we kind of tried to keep you in the dark on
yeah,
that procedure.
So.
Oh, I guess in thinking back, those are the main things that I remember. I don't know whether my mother has any stories to tell on.
Did you all ever sled down the big hill right up the street unless they closed off in the wintertime?
Yeah.
I don't remember our having that privilege. Where'd you get it?
Hill they closed off?
Where was that? The hill was
must
near.
Have been
the hill
we
was. Where was the hill near?
Near where we lived on.
Fort 12
Street.
Fort 12 Street.
4 o'clock?
Yeah, 2 or 3 blocks.
You know, at the Grand Big Hill, they used to close.
I hear somebody. Somebody's talking here who hasn't spoken before. I wonder if you would give that, if you can, to that young. You don't stretch it too far.
Move in.
That's right. Maybe you can just stand up there. Mama has given the microphone to a young man who has come over and usurped her chair. Tell us who you are, why you're holding that microphone, and what it is you intend to do with it.
Well, my name is Alvin Emanuel, and I'm the last son of what we call a baby son of the family. I am nicknamed Ramrod. I have an experience that was small. Maybe mother don't remember it, but she come up day missing one of her favorite bed sheets, which she had paid a lot of money for, and at that time was very ingenious of making experiments. So I decided to make a parachute with this favorite bed sheet. So I had planned for 6 months, had strand 600 sheets of coil wire to attach this, 12 feet long. After working 8 months with this project, I finally had attained it. And one morning when she was asleep, I decided now is my time, the wind is right, and I'm going to try this parachute. So I got outside and I folded according to what I could have calculated it would have been in a professional chute. And the wind had come up, and just at the right moment, I had opened the chute, it blossomed out into a beautiful sight. Well, it was all right, it blossomed out, but the thing is, it had begun to pull me down the street because it was bigger than me. Well, there were 4 men working in construction, and they started laughing, and they were laughing so hard the tears were coming in their eyes. But after they had got over their parental grief, they decided to help me. And though they, well, one of them was 300-pound man, very heavy built, and there were about 4 of them, and it began to drag them down the street. So finally, he decided he had a rope ladder, and one of them grabbed the rope ladder, and it was attached to a 2.5-ton truck, and that stopped. So I decided right there, no more experiments.
Thank you, Mr. Wright.
So I'll turn it back to James now.
What?
Put that twine around Alvin's head and make it do curls, and he hits you in the head with a hammer.
Ah! Now we're coming.
Hit me in the head, yeah. I remember when he hit me in the head with a hammer.
I assume it was a toy hammer.
Oh no, it wasn't. It was a regular hammer.
Christine, did you say that it was not a toy hammer?
I said it was not a toy hammer.
I thought you said just a few moments before that you don't remember the incident at all.
Well, not that incident I remember.
Oh, you mean that you were hit in the head with a hammer twice?
What are you implying, sir?
I'm implying that we're trying to get a few memories. These memories unearth facts which will help us understand you, and I feel that we should have these memories.
Mother, tell about the chicken
on
the
Goodness.
Reference has been
that's
made.
That's on Raymond.
Is that on Raymond?
Right. Yeah, that's the best time to tell.
What do you tell?
Did you say, Gladys, that this story that you've asked for might be named The Chicken in the
Privy?
Yes.
Yes, it does sound interesting.
All right,
perhaps Mama
you
will tell that story for us. We're now waiting for the story, this classic little tale entitled The Chicken in the Privy.
Hurry up, Mother, don't waste the time.
Oh, there, at one time we were raising chickens, and we had some beautiful white raw hens. And in those days they had those outhouses, which we called privies, instead of what we call now bathrooms, you know, toilets. So one of these hens, I don't remember where Raymond was running these chickens and got them frightened or not, but this one hen flew in this privy, and he went in to get her, and she flew down in the...
Oh, we understand.
Oh,
whatever.
It was a practically new one.
New chicken or new?
A new crib. So, I says, Raymond, we just can't afford to lose her if possible. So, wonder if you could, if there was some way that I could let you down with a rope. And we'd hold the rope and pull, and you could go down and reach her, catch her wings, and pull her up. So we did, and Raymond went down there, and he caught her. He had quite a struggle, but he come up.
Could you briefly describe the struggle that took place
with him? With the fluttering of wings, et cetera.
I should think that the fluttering wings would cause him some embarrassment.
Yes, and the cackling, and of course the odor wasn't so very pleasant, but he survived the ordeal, and we rescued the lovely, big, fat, white rock hen.
Was she still alive?
And you referred to individual named who? Raymond?
Raymond.
Who is this
He
person?
Was my eldest son. He was about 10 years old, I think, at the time.
And this took place
in Alliance, Nebraska.
In Alliance,
what
Nebraska.
We call Hills Edition.
Hills Edition.
Of Alliance.
And we lived in Hills Edition.
Mm-hmm.
I see. Now, have one of the others of you thought of a new story you'd like to add at this time? Or if not, we'll find out who some of these other people are who have been listening in on our reminiscences. I see a man and a boy and a lady, or should I say a lady and a man and a lady and a gentleman and a boy. So, to be chivalrous, we will give the microphone first to the lady. Tell us who you are, what you are doing here, and how you can contribute to this series of recollections.
I need to be mad.
You wouldn't have said that.
That wife of the recorder.
What is that?
Recollections.
What's that article you have in your clutch so feverishly in your right hand?
Oh, this is a Kleenex.
All right.
I found the story about the chicken in the privy. Very interesting. I can only add to your recollections by recalling something that I heard you tell me about, which involved Gladys. Something from your childhood. You were telling me that you and A.D. used to try to high jump. That one day the two of you had been playing and you had been trying for about an
several
hour.
Several of us.
Well, I remembered just that you mentioned you and A.D. and you'd been trying for about an hour to jump over a stick, which you had moved up to about 5 feet maybe, I don't know. But anyway, you said that you'd been trying so hard, you'd run and you'd try to jump and you'd knock the stick down and neither of you could jump it. And that Gladys sauntered out of the house and walked down and she said, "What are you doing?" And as she said that, she just ran and she jumped the stick, cleared it, and looked back, and you and A.D. were so embarrassed that you refused to tell her what you had been doing.
Yes, I recall that happened in Denver. A.D. really wasn't involved. There were several of us, maybe five or six or seven boys who'd been trying to jump a rope that had been stretched at a 5-foot level between the porch and some upright stick in the ground. And we had sweated and tried for some time. And Gladys did come out of the porch. I think we lived on Clarkson Street. And she was munching a sandwich. And we, in our labors, were in no mood to be disturbed by a girl. And we didn't even answer her when she says, "What are you doing?" And then she did come up and easily cleared the 5-foot rope and went on back into the house. So we were We were put out.
Knowing you, I know that you were put out.
I think Gladys acted as if she didn't remember that.
I do remember it, and I'm really ashamed to say that my experience in this feat may have been running from dogs and jumping fences in Alliance, Nebraska.
Yeah, I do
Which
remember.
Means that you had had good practice.
Yes.
Yes, yes, you ought to. Perhaps we can have a word from that gentleman sitting over there listening. Don't strike it. Perhaps he'll come over and tell us who he is and maybe add something.
I am Olmstead Smith, and I'm Dorothy's husband. Dorothy Christine's husband. I don't have any recollections that I've heard from this family. However, all of the stories I've heard today have been very interesting, and some of them have explained quite a few things, especially the story of the hammer hitting my wife. I shall be cognizant of that from now on.
I trust that Smitty's recollection of this incident will enable him to look with more charity on the victim of such an unfortunate incident in her youth. And this victim now is laughing, and perhaps she'd have something to say to enhance this little story.
Well,
let's call this the incident of the hammerhead.
Well, the only thing I can say to that is that I don't think my husband should have made that statement. Because he has tried to make it sound worse than it was in the past. For instance, one day about 2 or 3 years ago when he was going to school, he was taking some of his last courses in psychology. I was washing dishes in the kitchen, and he comes creeping around the refrigerator with this red book open in his hand and looking very silly. And he says, "Quick, quick, when I give you a name, I want you to tell me the first thing that comes to your mind." And I got tickled because he was looking so silly and had done this thing to me all of a sudden, and I started giggling and I couldn't stop. So then he turned to another page, another chapter about psychosis, and said that people who giggle, wriggle, twist, and display other nervous mannerisms have a definite mental problem. So I don't think this is quite a fair analogy, what he said to me on this hammer business. And I want to so state here and now that hammer didn't affect me at all.
Well, I think all we can do is to take in consideration both sides of this argument and walk down the middle of these two roads that have been so significantly cleared for us, and figure out for ourselves what the truth is. Now, Mama, do you have something else you can say? And we can continue this later on when other members of the family are present.
Mm-hmm. Well, I wonder if I could talk about you again, James.
I would say that you could make an attempt to do so.
Okay.
And since I'm at the control of the machine, I'll make the adequate adjustment. All right.
This also happened in Alliance. James was home from camp. And so we had some friends that ran a chicken farm. And they raised milk-fed chicken. You remember that?
I think I know
what you're saying. And so he went over to this home to play cards. And he was late getting back. So when I heard him come in, I asked him if he was hungry. And he says, yes, I could eat a bite. And I had a dish of this one of these milk-fed chickens, a great big dish, and they were extra large chickens, but they were quite young and tender. I had 8 large pieces of chicken on this, which I was saving for his breakfast. So when I went and looked in the icebox the next morning, there wasn't a sign of any chicken there. And that was 2 o'clock at night when he came home, and James had ate up all that chicken and chewed the bones. So he didn't have any chicken for breakfast.
I do remember that incident. Yes, and the camp that my mother refers to is a CCC camp in Wellington, Kansas, and I had come back for Christmas, not a vacation, but I had a several days leave, and I was hungry. And I do have some blurry vision of that heaped plate, and I did go to work on it most industriously. And I dare say that what you say is largely true.
That was good chicken.
Now, to continue from where we left off, I think I ought to say that now we have with us a person who participated in the chicken incident. None other than one of the victims, Raymond. That should be accompanied by the flapping of the wings. Maybe you'll tell us who's with us now, who's in the house, and who and what they're doing.
Are you asking me?
Yes.
Well, he's over there grinning real silly, and Charlene's holding her umbrella and her to her nose now. We just left the room, and Mama's in there trying to cook. And the smoke is something terrible, and I'm in big trouble, see.
You know, I'm taking advantage of you in this way. I gave the people that I talked with this morning a chance to think. But knowing that you think rapidly, I don't think you require this extra preparation. I ask each one of them to tell some experience out of their childhood which they found either interesting or pleasant or both, and which involved Mom. Now, while I'm still talking, I know your mind has been working because I see your eyes moving from one side to the other. I see the watch of your hand of your watch has speeded up, and I see that your I see adrenaline racing in your system, too, so I know that you are ready to recount something. Right?
Just being born has been a great thrill to me. My childhood days have been something. Boy, that was a quick one, wasn't it? Yeah. But I think that I think I'll pass around.
Passing, you better be sure. I tell you what you might do. Is that television on?
Yes,
it's
on. What
you might do is this. Before you pass, you might tell us just who this young lady on your left is, so that if and when she takes the microphone, we'll be tuned in on her identity, etc.
This is a great lady, my spouse, my charming and lovable wife, Mrs. Charlene Emanuel, and I'll give it to you now.
Yeah, but I thought you were going to ask me some questions.
You
yeah.
can spend some time, if you want to, telling us why you're not ready to talk. You see, that'll do just as well. It will record your voice.
Oh, yeah.
I did give the folks this morning a chance to think ahead of time. Well, I tell you what you might do. You might verify the fact that you are who you say you are.
Yes, I'm very delighted to know the family, and I've enjoyed the 18 years of with
shall I say? Just saying.
Yeah. I've enjoyed my married life very much.
Now, who is this man with the, you told us who that was. Now, let's tell you what you might do. Tell us the date.
Oh,
what is the date?
December the 11th, 48.
This is the year you got married, the date of your marriage.
Yes.
Okay. Now let me switch and ask you what day today is.
7:15.
Seven, oh, this is Army style. 1567?
14,
yeah. This lady made a mistake, and what I'm interested in is to find out just why she made the mistake. She mentions the 15th. What's so different about
the 15th? That was his birthday. That's why.
Was it whose birthday?
My husband's birthday.
July the 15th. Big one must not forget.
Yes.
Now let's see.
Why don't you cast that part out?
Okay, now Raymond says he's going to talk a little later. Now explain to us why you're going to talk later and what you will likely talk about and what you mean by later.
Well, later means that a dater at a dater late.
At a dater late,
see?
That's quite clear.
And the brand of bourbon that I'm drinking might change, and perhaps I'll be in a better position, and perhaps I'll feel better to be more explicit or illicit. And Ethan, look, if you roll your eyes at me one more time, I'm going to take my shoe off and throw it at you, see?
I see a weapon raised over your head.
Yes,
in the
well,
direction
that's
of the lady who just spoke. This on this companionable note, I think we'll...
Well, I can't think moment. Under... usually I can't think under duress.
Duress?
Yes.
You know, so far...
the threat of an umbrella or...
These remarks have been keyed on a level that all of us understand. When you mention a word like duress, then you have to tell us what you mean.
I read it in a magazine once, and it really thrilled me. See, I can't speak. Boy, that Ethan, actually, I love that gal. I can't speak like the rest of y'all, see?
Okay, on that note, I think we'll cut out.
Yeah, I think you better, because you're wasting some...
Welcome to my home for this very grand and glorious occasion, which means so much to me. Anything that any of us children have contributed in our lives of any importance or worth, I think if it had not been for the constancy and the devotion of our mother, this could not have happened. And so, Mommy, to you today, we pay a very special tribute. When the occasion arises, I exercise my talent of floristry, and so for each of you, my loved ones today, I did make a corsage and boutonniere. So if you will please come to the table, we will pin those on you before we start our program. We're having a little program this afternoon before we have our meal, and Julia Gladys and I are going to sing two trios. This, among our repertoire of songs that we sang when we were in high school, were The Green Cathedral by Carl Hahn, and Mighty Like a Rose by Ethelbert Nevin. The song The Green Cathedral, we sang at baccalaureate services in Alliance High School in 1934. I think that each of you remembers the gaiety that prevailed with our family at every occasion when dear Thomas was here, for he dearly loved each and every one of you in this room. And so in his memory, we would like to sing The Green Cathedral. Now, time, years have taken its toll on our voices in one way or another, and Julia is going to attempt to sing first soprano. Gladys is going to attempt second soprano. And if it appears that I am singing bass, I'm really not. I'm merely attempting to sing alto. All right, now, Ronnie.
Join hands above and
time, we'll have a reading by our mother. She has been taking creative writing. This is an article that she wrote at the end of the semester, mother. Come over here, mother. Mother?
Huh?
Come over here, please.
The barriers of time and distance have been fast falling apart under the impact of whirling automotive wheels. This transition is already apparent in a worldwide scope. Looking down from an airplane several thousand feet in the air, the limitations of the wheel is obvious. Traffic moves on restricted lines, yet around the plane extend the comparatively open reaches of airway, the new and expansive reaches of travel. Jet airliners from New York will assure the new era in travel. Passengers will have their lunches at New York, and perhaps 6 or 7 hours later sit down to dinner in London. The speed of the automobile has moved up from 15 miles an hour to 60 and even 70 miles an hour on many express highways. The farmer gets his produce to market on wheels with trucks, and tractors on farms have greatly decreased the horse and mule population. Children no longer walk to school. They are transported in buses. The farm produce are moved to the market on trucks, and the housewife, who once went to market on foot, now does her shopping mostly by family car. Hardly an action takes place of any significance independent of the movement of wheel-borne transports. Yet the wheel by itself is not the ultimate in the search for transportation. Faster and faster is a keynote of modern progress. This can never be done on wheels alone. Hence the genius of man turns from the wheel to the advancing era of the airways. Then the question arises, how does this affect the family? The status of family life in the United States. The home is now subject to the greatest strain to which it has been subjected in all of its history. All sorts of forces seem to conspire to wreck this foundation stone of civilization. The multiplication of machines seem to have a tendency to break it down. Family members scatter. The cost of living is constantly increasing. And in order to meet household expenses, it seems necessary for women to absent themselves from home as they become wage earners. In the good old days, father, mother, and the children all worked, played, and lived together under the same roof. Now all are scattered and go their separate, often selfish ways. As many ponder the security and other good things about home and busy days.
Thank you, mother. No matter what has happened to James in his life, we have always loved you, James, for the devotion and because of taking things in your stride through the years in your education. We have loved you very deeply for this. So to our illustrious brother, son, father, and husband, Dr. James Daniel.
And thanks for that generous introduction. And as I said before, I hope you're ready to listen to some poetry. What I wanted to do was read a few, 10 actually, of poems which I thought would be of the most interest to you because they're about a member of the family who is important. My son, who is the only grandson whose name is Emmanuel. I recall Mama's talking about families and how they sometimes go their separate ways. I think that families, like states and nations, are held together by affection more than anything else. And these poems, this series of poems that I've written about Jimmy, although two or three that I will read are not about him, have their source, of course, in that emotion, which is a family emotion and which can certainly bind us together. These 10 poems that I select have all been published before in various places, and so I won't mention the place of publication, but simply read the poem. This first one, and I'll read them in a roughly chronological order in that they cover some aspects of his life and his babyhood, I suppose I might say, on. It's called The Voyage of Jimmy Pooh. It was published in 1961. I suppose some of you have read it already. A soap ship went a-rocking upon a bathtub sea. The sailor crouched a-smiling upon a dimpled knee. Young Neptune dashed the waters against enamel shore and kept the air a-tumbling with bubble clouds galore. But soon the voyage ended. The ship was swept away by a hand that seemed to whisper, "No more games to them." The ship lay dry and stranded on a shiny metal tray, and a voice was giving orders that a sailor must obey. "Oh, Captain, little Captain, make room for just one more the next time we go sailing beyond the enamel shore." The next one is called Sad Face at Five. In this poem, I attempted to catch the beginning of sadness in a person's life as distinguished from those emotions which express themselves simply in tears. How came sorrow to his eye? On the one-winged butterfly, that orange half-mast on the twig, and the black cat's grassy dig and jungle gnat that snatched the bird down from the limb? No moan, no word for crippled notes. His leg alone felt knuckled denim at the bone. Or in the twist of traitor belt that whipped his lie, his martyr's wealth, the path he gave his friend to cross. Who took that baby boy? Whose loss will hug the paws in his embrace and nurse the musing in his face so bravely alive? Oh, sad face at five. The next one is called A Clown at Ten. I point out that Jimmy doesn't really quite like some of these and feel they paint him in a rather unfavorable stance, but audiences seem to enjoy most of them anyhow, seeing them as characteristic of children. In this next one, I attempt to point out, in A Clown at Ten, how parents and adults in general sometimes fail to understand what's going on in a child's mind. And the parents are actually the speakers in this poem. We should have guessed when he pounced home in a flailing dance, clucking like a hen possessed, elbows flapping in a sidelong prance, grinning grimly, mocking primly a saucy schoolmate's slur, the deep down bite of her. We should have known his pull-ups on the closet pole, his swimming in the kitchen zone, his pugilistic body roll on the church pew and museum pew were ways to storm the pass for the smallest in his class. Each noon he licked his silly grin and ate beyond our discipline. We called him fool and fed him shame, this little giant. The next I wrote for, actually,
a first class of students I read for in Manhattan, PS72. Even though this life, all the others that I've read, stems from some observations of, and this poem is entitled Snowman. I have a father watching a son, watching a snowman melt, and wondering if the son realizes the symbolic importance of a melting snowman, which takes on in this poem the appearance of approaching decay, death, as we call it. I watched him watch his snowman falling down. No collapse, no breaking parts, nothing to grapple with and hold, just smooth, small vanishing and leaning in the sun. He watched the carrot nose and finger-fashioned mouth turn bump and scar in whining air. But when the sweat dark brim of straw and charcoal eyes converged on the tilted pipe, he shoved to end his man undone. I watched the gathering in his face as he kicked snowy trash, growled engine sounds, plowed ditches rugged as his will on thawing grass. But his pity, it was not. My whim collapsed, broke up with trampled pipe and hat and sudden snowball whizzing by. Jimmy thinks some of these poems are hard to understand, so if you share his opinion. This next one isn't about him, it's about my belief that a person must act a little foolish sometimes in order to live. Title is A Fool for Evergreen. A little bit of fool in me hides behind my inmost tree and pops into the narrow path I walk, blindfolded by my wrath or shrunken by some twist of pain, some hope that will not wind again. He ogles with his antic eyes and somersaults a you're not wise until the patches in his pants go color wheeling through my glance, so fast that I cannot recall that I was mad or sad at all. A little bit of fool in me keeps evergreen my inmost tree. The next poem, which I read to you simply because it's about alliance or some fellow classmates, athletes I knew. You'll recognize perhaps their names. The poem explores the meaning of a champion. We think, we look back and say, men were men in my day, and they look at the youngsters and say they're weak. And I'm asking what a champion is here. Title is After the Record is Broken. My mind slips back to lesser men, their how, their when. Champions then. Big Stille with his bandaged hands broke through the Sydney line. The stands hysterical, profuse the rival bands. Poor Ackerman, his spikes undone, his strap awry, gave way to none, not even pride, the mile he won. Now higher, faster, farther, stars crossed, recede, and legends twinkle out, far lost, far discus spun, and javelin tossed, nor raise again that pull and sweat, that dig and burn, that crouch get set, a glimmer in old trophies yet. Now smoother, softer, trimmed for speed, the champion seems a better breed, his victory a showroom deed. Oh, what have we to do with men like champions that cry again, how high, how fast, how far? What then? Remember men, records fall. Unclap your hands, draw close your shawl. The lesser men have done it all. Here's one, number 7, if only 3 more to go. Called The Young Ones, Flip Side, in which I explore something about young people that we, as we grow older, forget. In tight pants, tight skirt stretched or squeezed, you hurt. Crammed in, bursting out, flesh will sing and hide its doubt. In nervous hips, hopping glance, usurping rouge, provoking stance, put off or put on, you hurt. And then it's gone. The next one, Mama might appreciate, since the sentiment in it might be called something that you see in Christian Science. It goes back to Plato, I suppose, into many ideas. The title is Whatever Broken Thing You Have. And I'm simply suggesting here that all of us must learn to let go of things, let go of them confidently. Whatever broken thing you have is past. Let go. Set free the fragments of design we cannot know. The pieces cannot last. Our little gasp of pain cannot align what is to be with what is done. Somewhere all splinters fit, except the one we keep. All craft adrift do float toward some care, or bubble cleanly down into the deep. One great design awaits. The island shifts, the sea remains, and all that seems to drown with unrecorded navies lulls and lifts a treasure world and wears a weedless crown. Cut loose, cast off, fear nothing at the bar. The shore will turn and come to where you are. Number nine. This poem I wrote when I found out that Jimmy, as well as some friends of his, each had a club, and in each club there was only one member. And I thought of this as the title, Club Fantastic. And I sent it to the editor, and he said, and I told him that I didn't realize until I was two-thirds of the way through that some people would think this had political implications. So he said to change it to Sun. I changed the sun. That's how it appeared. Cross-legged on his bed, the president is 12, signaling to order all his crew, himself as treasurer, chief spy, keeper of the chemicals, and only member, too. The minutes of Club Fantastic tell it all. The Indian heads, his paper route turned up for due. The four-way grid code messages he found in shoes. The fingerprints and buttons marked in basement hush. The friends he filed away and sent by brush. Barefoot at the desk, no one disturbs. The president nods over geometry and German verbs and Orwell's 1984. All done. What can a president do? Or treasurer, chief spy, keeper of the chemicals, too? When all of his fantastic crew, despite all signals, do they want. Founder of the club, the mystery of 12, how signal to do? How softly delve into your lonely sleep, that even there, even you, might close hands with this crew. And the last one I'll read, the subject of it, same young man, has never seen before. And it's the last poem that I have written. I wrote it on June 19th. It's called Fisherman. And Jimmy and I have been going fishing since he was 3. And this poem occurred to me when one day recently I went fishing with him. I found him fishing somewhere else, not by my side, but farther away. It occurred to me that an era in his life had passed when he no longer fished. When 3, he fished these lakes, curled sleeping on a lip of rock, crib blankets tucked from ants and fishbone flies, twitching as the strike of bass and snarling reel uncoiled my shouts, not quit till he jerked, blinking up on all fours, swaying with the winking leaves. Strong awake, he shook his cane pole like a spoon, and dipped among the wagging perch, still tied. He drew his silver rubber blade and poked the winding fins that tugged our string, or sprayed the dimpling minnows with his plastic gun, or rain struck, squirmed to my armpit in the poncho. 10 years uncurled him, fend him hard. Now far he casts his line into the wrinkled blue, and easy toes a rock, reel on his thigh till bone and crank cry out the strike he takes with man-child chuckles, cunning in his play of zigzag line and plunging silver. Now fishing far from me, he strides through rain, shoulders a spiny ridge of pines and disappears near lakes that cannot be, while I must choose to go or stay, bring blanket, blade, and gun, or stand a fisherman.
A particular memory, because Mother was always such a wonderful mother and so loving and kind, but one thing especially that I remember is that when I would always get ill, she would always come and rub my hair and pet me and tell me that I was her baby, and she'd buy me some ice cream. She always bought us ice cream when we were children. Other than that, I mean, she was always a very kind and sweet mother to us. We have those kind of memories about her. That's my comment.
Mine's already been told, but I'll tell another one. When I was in junior high school, a little friend of mine named Douglas Green threw a hoop, and he hit me and he cut a hole through my lip. All the way through, and I came home, Mama said, "That doesn't hurt, does it?" I said, "Yes, it does." "No," she says, "no, it doesn't, but it didn't hurt her, so I guess I didn't feel." Anyway, we had syrup and bread for dinner. And that's the sweetest memory I have.
Well, I could think of so many, many things that I could say that's complimentary to Mother. And then sitting, looking at all of us here together, I was commenting yesterday to Gladys how, or and Chris, how we've always been so close and loving. We have been nosy or meddlesome or envious of each other, anything that has happened. And I thought of the foundation of this. Mother never allowed us to fight when we were growing up or quarrel. And one time Raymond and James had some word about something, and she simply went in the other room and got the Bible and turn to a verse. She says, "Here, read this." I'll tell you what it is after I tell you another incident. One night, Janet and I were sleeping in bed, and I never liked anybody to put their feet on me. And I started fussing about that, and I complained, and Janet started crying. She went and got the Bible again. But this is a verse that she always made us read. "Be kindly affectionate, one toward another, with brotherly love, in honor preferring one another."